So, hey, everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on with Voices from the Frontlines, your 4 o'clock drive time, walk time, bicycle time, public affairs hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. Jeff, really nice to have you on the show. We're joined with Jeff Chang, Executive Director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University. Jeff has a movement background. He's a radical historian with both street cred, as they say, and academic chops. As somebody said, Jeff's first book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation, won the American Book Award, which is very cool. And his next book, which I'm looking forward to, is The Color, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Eric. It's great to talk to you.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the cultural wars in the presidential election. I mean, This is, of course, the first black president of the United States, and no one is confused about that. I mean, this election is about many things, but let's start with how you understand the cultural wars as the Republicans, Democrats are fighting out the presidential election.
Yeah, you know, I started writing this book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America, back in 2008, you know. And it was at that time, I think we were all ecstatic, probably too ecstatic.
Yep.
We can talk about that, but you know, at that particular moment, I think that the book was looking a lot different than it ended up becoming. At the beginning, it was about, you know, here's how America has slowly become colorized, demographically and culturally, and how cultural change really leads to political change in many respects. And as I got towards the end of finishing up, you know, the draft of the book, this summer I realized that the book really wasn't about that. It was about the continuation of the culture wars, by any means necessary on the part of folks like Mitt Romney. It's really interesting that we're talking today, you know, the day after Romney goes out and, talks about this magical 47% number, right? Sort of 47% who will never vote for him, who would never consider even voting for him, who can't even understand what this poor guy is about. And it's interesting because in many respects, this 47% number means a lot of things to a lot of folks on the far right. You know, Ralph Reed from the Christian Coalition, to him, the 47%, 46% represent Latinos, African Americans, women, and union households. Throw in Asian Americans in there as well, probably now. And these are folks who would never, you know, never come over to the Republican side. They're not going to do it. And here we have Romney talking about 47% who don't pay taxes, who are takers, they're not makers, who sort of feed off the fat of government. And what's really interesting to me is that, of course, the argument is absolutely racialized. This is going back to the culture wars of the 80s, where welfare recipients are wholly, you know, of color.
Right.
They're usually women of color, and you know, it's a continuation of that kind of line. But it's also astonishing, I think, in just how much it depends on sort of this nostalgia. This sort of notion that the world hasn't changed at all, or the world has changed for the worse, I should say, and that if we could just get it back to the days when whites were whites and the rich were rich and everybody knew their place, that is the America that we want to restore. Restoration is the major project of the far right.
I think the restoration for them probably goes back to 1865. You think about where they really want to go back to, think about that Romney is really discussing a civil war, right? He's discussing, which it is. There's a civil war going on in this country. So as you said, the 47%, as he said, people who want to live off the government, who have no will, only the hardest working people in show business, you know, as if the black community, the Latino community are not made up of people who never stop working, you know, who built this country based on work. So how the white elite turns the argument on the hardest working people as if they're the unworking beneficiaries of government. But as you point out, they've done the math. And they understand that this swing vote, because what he says, if I got 47% and he's got 47%, we're fighting over 6%. Why don't we talk about what that 6% looks like in the mind's eye of the Republicans?
Well, you know, the thing that I find is interesting is that I think that the 6% is a myth. I think that, in fact, they're living a huge lie. They've got a belief in a fantasy that we can actually go backwards in time. The reality is that all demographics are pointing towards nobody being a minority anymore, except for the 1%. You know what I'm saying? That we have no minority populations as soon as 2028 for folks under the age of 30. And as early as, you know, 2042, I guess folks are talking about. The year gets earlier and earlier,
right,
for everybody. Folks focus on this, folks who are focusing on this 6%, supposedly of swing votes in the middle, the so-called independent voter. There was an amazing study that was actually done early this year, on who the independent voter is. And the fact is nobody can really define the independent voter anymore. The independent voter could be, folks who are, middle class, living in the exurbs. They could be working class folks who are not interested in either party. What Obama did that was smart in 2008 is that he decided to try to, for the first time, really, since going back to the 1930s for the Democratic Party, tried to expand the party, tried to move away from these notions that what you really had to do was to target this middle. And for me, you know, looking at that middle through the 90s and through the 80s, these were folks who were constructs. These were people that Mark Penn, the pollster for Clinton, had created. These were soccer moms. These were NASCAR dads. These were white conservative voters that they were trying to pull over to the party because they were still trying to fulfill some sort of kind of Southern strategy, modified Southern strategy from the Nixon sort of Southern strategy in which he said, forget the blacks, you know, we're just going to go for the whites. In this particular instance, it was sort of white voters who would still respond to anti-welfare messages. And I think that day is gone. I think that we actually are moving very rapidly towards a new cultural majority. And I think this is what I was trying to document in this book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America, is that as we look forward to this, notions of the 47%, the 6%, all of that stuff is all wrong. That what we need to look at is where the country is moving to.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, where it's
okay,
moving
sure.
to, Jeff. That we're talking to Jeff Chang. Just a couple of thoughts. I mean, I was writing some notes. Just take a minute. Let me go with a couple of thoughts. I mean, on first hand, you have the overt racism, the Obamacare, just even the use of the word Obama has become like a curse word in the eyes of the way that the right talks about him. I mean, they don't ever call him President Obama. They just literally call it as a curse word. Romney says, I know where my birth certificate is, talking about Kansas. Obama's the food stamp president. Obama doesn't want welfare recipients to work. So it's not even racially coded. It's just racially, you know, it's just racist.
It's just there.
So that's,
yeah.
that's
it's
number.
It's not even dog whistle. It's a whistle.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. It's a
right.
whistle we can all hear.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, just is my triad here. But the second aspect, which complicates it, is that President Obama, this is my view, contributes to the mass incarceration of black and Latino youth. He pushes the war on crime and drugs. As you and I both share, the Justice Department attacks medical marijuana in every effort to decriminalize, which is a high percentage of black and Latino kids. Obama sides with the MTA in Los Angeles against our civil rights charges and the mass incarceration and deportation of 1.2 million Latino immigrants under his watch. So you have on one hand, he's being attacked in an absolutely racist manner, but his policies are not, unfortunately, anti-racist. And then to make the third one complicated, which I'll let you unravel, is, and he does not want to talk about race. So we become his defenders correctly on the anti-racist message at the same time that he will not speak out. How do you unravel, Jeff?
It's a pickle. It's absolutely a pickle. And for us, you know, what we've been doing a lot on the grassroots level is to try to pull together artists, particularly around the issue of migrant justice and immigrant rights, to try to turn the story back around, because, you know, we've been really concerned, I think, with Obama becoming the deporter in chief.
Right.
He has, as you said, deported 1.2 million folks. Just recently it was revealed that all of the young people who would have qualified for the DREAM Act, who he had removed from immediate deportation proceedings, are now not going to be able to qualify for health care, which is a huge reversal. And and so what we've been trying to do is to move the debate beyond that through the arts, through having writers and visual artists and other creative folk tell stories to try to move that. And I think that this is, in a lot of ways, what part of what we need to do movement-wise is to be able to create that pull that the president then must react to. He didn't make the decision around the Dream Kids in isolation. He did it because there was massive pressure from the Latino community. He did it because there were students who were sitting in across the country in his campaign offices from Denver all the way to Florida.
That's right.
He did it under a lot of pressure. And he did it because Jose Antonio Vargas, brave soul and amazing soul that he is, was able to tell his story on the cover of Time magazine. I mean, it literally, the announcement came hours after the magazine had hit the streets. And so he's susceptible to our pressure, I think, on these issues that we care so much about, from incarceration to economic justice, foreclosures, and all the other kinds of stuff that we've been fighting so hard for all these years.
Well, one of the things you talk about in some of your writing is the role of the narrative, and I think you know that most good organizers know the role of the narrative, use the role of the narrative. Tell us some of the organizing that you're doing in terms of artists, in terms of media. Where do you see some of the cutting-edge work being done around trying to figure out strong anti-racist messaging with strong punchlines and trying to break certain norms?
Well, you know, one of the things is to note that culture and artists helped Obama get elected, straight up.
That's right.
You know, there was this explosion of art, as we saw from the beginning of 2008 all the way through the elections, and you couldn't go anywhere without seeing Obama become literally the image of change. And, you know, part of that is to recognize that that's the kind of power that we have the power to be able to change the message, to actually presage political change, to presage social change. You can take it back, right? You can take it all the way back to Jackie Robinson, you know, taking the field 7 years before Brown versus Board of Education, or Ellen DeGeneres coming out on TV, you know, like 13 years before Don't Ask, Don't Tell gets repealed and same-sex marriage, Obama indicates his interest and support of it. So that's the role that artists can play, and I think that that's what we share in this notion of cultural organizing, with all of the amazing organizing models that we've drawn upon over the years. And so, you know, a lot of the efforts that we're doing around immigration these days, I think, are there at the cutting edge. And we're doing culture strike stuff all across the country. We've been working with a lot of undocumented young people, a lot of folks who call themselves undocu queer, to do events in different cities where the immigration debate has been raging, and to be able to launch poster campaigns around issues like SB 1070. We've also been able to do a lot of writing. We've been able to organize writers to be able to tell the stories. We've got a bunch of books that are coming out this fall from Jeff Biggers, State Out of the Union, whom you should definitely try to talk to. He's looking at Arizona, to Ruben Martinez's Desert America. There's a whole bunch of pieces that are coming out around these types of issues to try to humanize the issue. And I think that that's essentially where cultural organizing comes in, is to, you know, with immigration, the debate has been reduced to questions of literally formal legalistic kind of language. I mean, literally we're talking about legal and illegal. Whereas if you look back to the immigration rights marches back in the middle part of the last decade, during that time, it was amazing to see the polls shift as people began to hear about all of the different stories that undocumented immigrants were telling at that particular moment. And that's basically what our belief is. The power of the story, at the end of the day, is what's going to change people's minds and lead to better policies.
Well, you know, I think that there needs to be a combination of stories and narratives and what I call counter-hegemonic demand development. Like, I think the question of open borders, which is totally open to everybody, understands it in 1 second. You know, we have a, we've been doing just a couple of things, Jeff. Like, we've been doing, at the Strategy Center, we have a slogan, Free the U.S. 2 million. And people say, well, what do you mean, free the U.S. 2 million? And we say, well, free all the prisoners. Now, do we mean every single prisoner? No, we don't. But we mean the overwhelming majority. And we've been doing a lot of work by starting the conversation at Free the U.S. 2 million to totally change the terms of the debate or the concept of open borders, which is very clear. It doesn't necessarily mean that people agree, but wow, as opposed to hearing these immigrant rights groups talking about comprehensive immigration reform. Well, I can't imagine, what would you rather have, castor oil or comprehensive immigration reform? I'm not sure. They're both equally unattractive to me. You know, so come up with a slogan, guys. I mean, come on, you got to do better than that. You know, yeah. So I think we want to talk about, and you could play a big role in this, Jeff, seriously, is tying narrative to very clear demands. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah. I agree. I totally agree. I mean, the notion of, you know, prison abolition is neatly encapsulated in that Free the U.S. 2 million.
That's right.
And I think that the notion of, you know, open borders, it's something to say to people. It's like, look, 40 years ago, was there a huge wall that was stretching from the California coast all the way across, you know, to the Texas border? No, there wasn't. Folks, you know, were able to move back and forth. And you didn't see the kind of heartache that you see now, the sort of, you know, craziness that you have in the media about things, people destroying economies and so on and so forth. This is the way that people lived. And to say, look, this is how people have lived for thousands upon thousands of years before those borders got established. And really, if you look at the walls, they've only been there for a good 20 years. And to contrast that kind of thing, I think, gives them an image in their heads that sort of they have to challenge and make some rethink things. I think that the narrative shaping around, for instance, the Occupy movement, and I know you've done a lot of talking about this, has been really powerful to be able to reshape people's notions of what is powerful, possible, is really at essence the power of arts and culture. And the other part of it is that we live in culture. We're immersed in culture all of the time. So people, you know, talk a lot about politics. It's episodic. It's not where people are at all the time. And even then, you can't get everybody to pay attention to it. But this is why culture needs to move first. If you are able to take these powerful ideas, infuse them into the culture, make them the norm in the way that seeing gay couples, for instance, you know, became the norm, then policy will naturally have to follow. The weight of history is moving in your direction.
Yeah, and the wave. I mean, one of the things, you know, we'll continue the conversation. We have a few more minutes because I think your work is really important. And one of the things that, in terms of my cultural/political work, is I'm doing a lot of thinking about, obviously, the role of spoken words, which is maybe the main arena in which I operate, written and spoken words. But I was raised with, hell no, we won't go. No Viet Cong ever called me the N-word. You know, the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. The ballot of the bullet. If you read, you know, which you do, of course, you read Malcolm, you read King, you read Du Bois, The Land of the Thief and the Home of the Slave, which is the Niagara Movement, I watched the way they crafted their agitation and they used politics and culture in some way in a more integrated manner. And I'm interested in what you think about that in terms of where the movement might be going now.
Well, I think the future is in the image. And I think one of the most powerful images actually came out this summer during the Democratic Convention. It was the image of a butterfly. Butterflies are, you know, of course, these animals that migrate, you know, millions of them, and they don't know any borders. They just naturally move from the north to the south during the course of the year, and they move back from the south to the north. And so that was the image that the undocumented students crafted, and they flooded Charlotte with it, you know, this past summer. And it was powerful. It was one of those things that allows you to really understand, hey, these are movements of people. People move all the time. You might move from Kansas to California. You know, these are people who are moving from Guatemala to, you know, to Georgia. And so It humanizes and it makes things real and it makes things visceral and it makes things felt. And I think that in that way it continues in the long legacy of, you know, the young artists today continue in the long legacy of folks going all the way back, like you said, to the Niagara movement, to the civil rights movement, you know, to the anti-war movement, of the 1960s all the way up to right now.
And I think a very important cultural shift is the move from Fred Armisen to Jay Farrow, don't you think? I think that's one of the great cultural moves in the last week.
A profound change, no doubt. The president's finally been colorized.
No kidding. It only took us 4 years. Well, listen, one of the things I think is great, and I want to thank you for the work you're doing, is that I think you are to be a bridge, Jeff, between social movements, artists, hip-hop artists, and I want to talk to you next time about the center at Stanford. We got 1 minute. What's your 1 minute? So I did mine. What's your 1 minute soundbite you want to get out with, Jeff?
Cultural change precedes political change, so change the culture.
All right, we got a deal. Jeff, we're going to have her on again, and really nice to be with you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Eric. Take
care.